You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
We are witnessing the highest number of armed conflicts since the end of the Second World War.
Do you feel that this is being driven by the Kremlin?
Yes.
Iran's nuclear ambitions have been obliterated.
The daddy thing, I didn't call him daddy.
They don't know what the f*** they're doing. Do you understand that?
Welcome to World News Weekly. Joining me is SBS World News journalist Claudia Farhat. Just another quiet week in the world. Hey, Claudia.
Hello, Kat. So much can happen in a day, especially in a week like this. On the weekend, we had Pakistan nominate Donald Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize. Less than 24 hours later, he dropped the US's most powerful non-nuclear bombs on Iran. Awkward timing, right? Pakistan's now looking at withdrawing its recommendation.
Yep, highs and lows for the self-professed peace-loving president. This week, we take you through all the unfolding events of the Israel-Iran conflict, as well as what the future might hold for the Iranian regime.
Yeah, we've also got big bucks being promised at the NATO summit in The Hague as European leaders look to appease the US president.
But first, Trump's decision to enter the war in the Middle East.
Tonight I can report to the world that the strikes were a spectacular military success. Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely and totally obliterated. There's no military in the world that could have done what we did tonight.
And of course, the world was waiting with bated breath as US President Donald Trump seemed unable to decide whether to join Israel's attacks on Iran. That uncertainty clearly resolved over the weekend when the US bombed three key nuclear sites in Iran, including Fordow, Iran's main facility. But it's unclear as yet if it really did obliterate it. And Iran had warned such intervention from the US would bear consequences, which we saw come to fruition when Iran hit a US airbase in Qatar. Trump's response to thank Iran. A ceasefire was then announced by Trump to stop the exchange of strikes between Israel and Iran on Monday, only for the warring parties to quickly break this truce and receive a scolding from the president. It seems the ceasefire is now holding. Claudia, talk us through the logistics behind the Operation Midnight Hammer, as the US are coining it.
Well, everyone was watching and waiting to see if the US was going to enter the war. That's what we were talking about last week on the pod. But somehow this attack still managed to go undetected and take Iran by surprise. All eyes were on the US's B-2 stealth bombers. These are the only warplanes capable of carrying its most powerful 30,000-pound bunker-busting bombs, which up until now had only been used really in a testing capacity. The US was obviously aware of all that attention, and they kind of seemed to play into it, because on Friday night, eight of these bombers took off from Missouri in a decoy mission. They headed west over the Pacific towards the US territory of Guam, and they were being closely watched by online flight trackers. And while everyone was watching them, another seven B-2s took off in the opposite direction. They made no communication with ground control or with each other in the air as they flew east over the Atlantic completely unnoticed. They were in the air for 37 hours in total. Wow. They were refueled midair. They were escorted by about 120 other fighter jets and reconnaissance planes, surveillance planes, but they still went undetected. And as they reached the Lebanese coastline in the Mediterranean, a US submarine in the Arabian Sea fired a bunch of cruise missiles that were timed perfectly to coincide with the bombers reaching Iran. Once they got there, they unloaded those massive bombs on three targets, the nuclear facilities at Fordow, Natanz and Isfahan, completely unopposed because Iran's air defences had already been decimated by Israel's strikes of the week prior. So it seems all that talk from Trump about giving himself 2 weeks to decide whether or not he was going to strike and how he likes to make his decisions at the very last second was maybe all part of the distraction. There's now questions over how long this plan was actually in the works, because some of the assets that were used in this operation were put in place before Israel even began its strikes on Iran.
And Trump is heralding this as a huge success, claiming the US obliterated Iran's nuclear program, as you mentioned. The preliminary intelligence report by the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency seems to be suggesting otherwise. Can you explain the discrepancy between Trump's claims and the intelligence we have so far?
Yeah, well, not just a huge success, but in Trump's own all caps words on Truth Social, one of the most successful strikes in military history, even, that, quote, completely and totally obliterated Iran's nuclear facilities. Well, it's already clear that that's probably not the case, even by the US's own intelligence reports. So the Pentagon's early assessment is that the strikes did not destroy Iran's nuclear program and likely only set it back by a few months. That assessment isn't public, but some of the details have been leaked to the press, and that's what we've been seeing. We know Iran before this had about 450 kilograms of uranium enriched to 60% purity, which would have been enough to make about 10 nuclear warheads if it was enriched one step further to 90% or weapons grade. Apparently, that stockpile was not destroyed in these strikes. We knew there'd been plenty of speculation in the lead up that Iran was moving those stocks to a safer place ahead of the strikes, anticipating that they might happen. That may well be what's happened here.
Yeah, and we should note a report has just come out as well by the director of the United States Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, and they've brought forward a slightly different analysis, saying the nuclear sites were severely damaged and would take years to rebuild, but stopped short as well of saying they were entirely eliminated. Although we should take these reports with a grain of salt amid all the political outcry against the preliminary report by the Trump administration. But there are also now questions over whether Iran's centrifuges, the machinery that's used to enrich uranium, were destroyed. If they weren't, Iran would still have capacity to keep adding to that stockpile, wouldn't they?
Yeah, if the centrifuges are intact, even if they had lost some of the stockpile, which we're not sure if they have, then certainly they could keep adding to it. We know much of these three nuclear facilities are buried deep underground. In the case of Fordo, about 80 to 90 metres under a mountain. These bunker busters are designed to tear through about 60 metres of earth before detonating, but they can only really get through about 20 metres of concrete. And we know Fordo is built with heaps of protections around it. Satellite pictures from the site, from Fordo, have shown craters in the ground around it, but it's still too early to say whether there's been any internal damage to the underground site, to where the bulk of that facility is. All of this, we should say, is just based on early intelligence. So the assessment could change as the US gets more information. That's already what we're seeing with the new reports from the CIA. And as you mentioned, the White House has already jumped on these reports of the Pentagon intelligence, saying they're just flat out wrong. But, you know, they are largely in line with what analysts have been telling us for years, that military action alone can't dismantle the nuclear program. They've always said strikes may set the program back by a bit, but you then run the risk of making Iran even more determined to build a nuclear weapon. Right now, there's talk of de-escalation, but these things don't always happen instantly. I think we could still be seeing the repercussions of these strikes for years to come.
The sounds we just played were that of missiles striking Qatar airbase, and they were played out on Iranian state television. Iran had warned the US of retaliation if they were to join Israel's strikes, and that is what happened. Claudia, was this a genuine retaliation, or was Iran just trying to save face?
Well, Iran had been threatening to attack the US's bases and assets in the Middle East if Washington did join Israel's strikes. So Washington has eight bases in the region, and the one that Iran did hit, Al Udeid, is the largest. It usually hosts about 8,000 US troops. But it seems like this was more of a symbolic strike, so Iran could say, we've punished the US for what they've done, rather than a genuine retaliation. And that's because hours before those Iranian missiles were fired towards Al Udeid, Qatar temporarily closed its airspace. The US and the UK told all their citizens in the country to shelter in place, and satellite images showed most of the US's aircraft that were at Al Udeid were removed from the base's runways, moved to safety. Donald Trump says through their back channels, Iran essentially warned the US that this retaliation was coming so they could prepare for it. And that's why we saw him thank them for showing restraint afterwards. All the missiles, bar one, that Iran fired off were intercepted. That one was apparently only allowed to land because it was headed for an open space anyway. And in the end, there were no casualties or any significant damage reported. Had Iran actually staged a genuine retaliation against the US's military personnel or assets in the region, one that was actually aimed at doing real harm, it would have paved the way for certain escalation. It's now clear, though, that that's not what the Iranians wanted, but that, yeah, they still did need to do something as to not appear weak in the face of these US attacks.
Israel, as soon as we made the deal, they came out and they dropped a load of bombs, the likes of which I'd never seen before. So I'm not happy with them. I'm not happy with Iran either. But I'm really unhappy if Israel's going out this morning. You know what? We basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the f*** they're doing. Do you understand that?
A very angry Donald Trump on the south lawn of the White House there, blasting both Israel and Iran for violating the ceasefire he had only just announced to the world via a stunning Truth Social post. There's certainly something very bizarre still, at least to me, about this sort of real-time, almost live streaming of diplomacy via social media.
Yeah, it all began in all caps, as is Trump tradition. Congratulations to everyone, he wrote. He went on to say Israel and Iran had agreed to a complete and total ceasefire to end what he said should be called the 12-day war, quote, on the assumption that everything works as it should, which it will. But of course, Kat, it did not.
No, it didn't. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei took to social media shortly before Trump's announcement, saying Iran would not surrender. And then after the post, there was actually an 8-hour delay for confirmation from Israel once this ceasefire was announced by Trump. And this all coinciding with details of violations and strikes in the lead up to the ceasefire and after it came into effect.
Yeah, Trump's outburst did seem to have its desired effect eventually, though. The strikes stopped and both sides now seem to be honouring that ceasefire. Although, as we've seen in the past, that could change at any moment.
Precisely. And to talk us through what might happen next, we've got Deakin University International Relations Lecturer Andrew Thomas on the pod. Thanks so much for joining us, Andrew.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. Pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the ceasefire. Do you expect it to hold? And why do you think both sides have agreed now?
I mean, anything's possible, but I don't expect it to hold. Right now, nobody's happy. Nobody's really gotten what they wanted. It's quite clear that Israel started these exchanges for one thing, and that was to, in my view, to derail the nuclear talks between the United States and Iran. But that became something very different very quickly, publicly saying that they were interested in regime change. That is clearly the policy of Israel at the moment. From the United States' point of view, clearly they wouldn't have been negotiating the nuclear deal if they didn't want one, whether it's under Trump or not. You know, he tore up the initial nuclear deal, the JCPOA, but he has always wanted to have a deal of his own. But from Iran's perspective, if anything, the last 12 days have shown that have proven to them that a nuclear weapon might actually be a very good idea. In fact, some officials have said that we are pursuing a policy of nuclear ambiguity, just like Israel. Maybe we have them, maybe we don't. Maybe we get them, maybe we don't. And that, to me, says that they're genuinely considering moving forward with a nuclear program.
Yeah. So on the nuclear program, we know it likely hasn't been destroyed in full. I mean, there are conflicting intelligence reports. But what could the future hold for the nuclear aspirations of Tehran, do you reckon?
Based on the intelligence reports that I assume you're referring to, we're talking about sending back the Iranian nuclear program for about 5 to 6 months. And that really is the problem of nuclear enrichment. Once you open the Pandora's box of enrichment, you can get fissile material from pretty much anywhere. It's the knowledge that you're really talking about. And once that you've got that knowledge, you know, you can't unopen that Pandora's box. The problem now is the negotiation window, in my view, has now closed. Taking on the position of the Iranians, why would the Iranians ever trust the United States again? On the one hand, they probably say, oh, you can't control your ally, Israel, or this was a conscious trap. And you led us into a trap. Neither of those are acceptable to the Iranians. So unless there is a very good deal on the table for them, I don't see them returning to nuclear negotiations again.
And there were no deaths or injuries reported in Qatar following Iran's strike. And Tehran did give notice of this attack. But can we expect this retaliation to upset Trump supporters who had hoped the president would really stick to his promise of the US not entering into any new conflicts?
This really does seem to be a wedge issue for some of his base. You know, a lot of people elected him, it turns out, as an anti-war president, as an isolationist president. But in this specific outcome, I think some pundits are trying to spin this by saying this is similar to what happened to Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds force that the United States assassinated in 2020, where they showed peace through strength, which is a word that you're hearing a lot in this administration right now, by killing this official. The Iranians bombed a U.S. base in Saudi Arabia, and that was the end of it. They're trying to spin that way to sort of say, well, Iran's not calling our bluff here. They'll never call our bluff. But from what we know from Iran, they tend to operate and retaliate in very different ways than sort of traditional military strikes in the future. They tend to use proxies. And right now, those proxies are quite weak. They've been weakened in Lebanon. They've been weakened in Yemen. They've been weakened in Iraq. But they won't stay weak forever. There's been a lot of animosity created within the Iranian elite establishment that I would imagine eventually U.S. soldiers or officials will be in danger because of this.
Yeah, so Israel hasn't been shy about its other goal here, pursuing regime change in Iran. How weakened do you think the regime is by all this, by this 12 days of war? And what do you think happens next if it is toppled?
The regime has been significantly weakened, at least militarily. And I think that they are seeing this as a golden opportunity to try and change Iran's position in the region. That being said, within Iran, there aren't that many alternative options. There expressly aren't a lot of, if any, alternative options that are friendly to the United States, let alone Israel. There's not like there's some sort of democratic opposition, unified democratic opposition sort of waiting in the wings, ready to take control. And of course, the history of that, the 1953 coup kind of looms large in Iran even today. Everybody is aware of when other nations, no matter how progressive they are, no matter how pro-democracy they are, about other nations getting involved in their politics.
Andrew Thomas, thank you so much for your time joining us on the pod this week.
Thank you so much.
We're hearing reports from Australians who are stuck in Iran. They're terrified of reprisals if they speak to Western journalists.
There is no ground that, you know, based on that a reprisal should take place, no.
So they're free to speak?
Of course, you know.
They're free to criticize the government?
Yes, the criticism in Iran is a matter of daily life.
That was Iranian Ambassador Ahmad Sadehi speaking to our chief political correspondent Anna Henderson in Canberra this week. The past 2 weeks of fighting seems to have brought about a new wave of repression within Iran. Human rights organizations say hundreds of people have been arrested since the bombings began for reasons ranging from spreading rumors online to acting suspiciously around military bases. Most stand accused of being Israeli spies. And while Israel does have spies in Iran, critics say the allegation is now being used to crack down on anyone seen as an opponent.
And state media has reported three more prisoners have been executed over their alleged spying for Israel, bringing the tally of executions for espionage around the war up to six since June 16. Joining us is Niv Sadro from SBS Persian. Niv, Iranians are, of course, particularly anxious at the moment as a fragile ceasefire has only just taken hold. Some are fearful the regime will use the war as an excuse to further roll back some small liberties gained in the past couple of years. And while there are many opposed to the regime, there's also anger at Netanyahu's calls for civilians to topple the regime. I know it's very difficult at the moment to actually get information out of Iran, but what are you hearing from Iranians?
Based on the chats that we had with activists and people inside Iran, I think most of the people are desperate now and super worried because usually with these type of scenarios, when it happens is that the suppression rises in Iran and we have an increase in suppression. What we have seen in recent days too, we had more than 700 arrests and executions. So many civilians and especially activists who are working against the regime in Iran are very worried about their future and their activity in Iran.
And what challenges have you faced getting information out of Iran at the moment?
So obviously there was internet blackout, especially during the conflict between Israel and Iran. Many people didn't have access to internet, and randomly just a group of people had access to internet. So it was so hard to get in touch with people, even if you wanted to try in Iran to call Iran directly from outside Iran, you couldn't. It was kind of banned to call or blocked to call Iran. The only way to get in touch was from people to call you directly from inside Iran. That was one of the biggest issues. On the other hand, people were also so worried to speak out because they're obviously so worried about reprisal or being persecuted. So they were so concerned to speak out about the situation and talk about their feelings.
Nev, it seems like there's less open opposition to the regime being shown right now, but at the same time, a tougher crackdown happening on any dissent. Why do you think we're seeing this wave of reprisals right now?
I think, as I mentioned, there's some people see that the regime is in their weakest position right now, and obviously they're worried about the survival, and obviously that all the threats that we had about regime change from both Donald Trump and Netanyahu has made them probably more worried. Last time after Israel attacked Iran, we had kind of similar thing going on in Iran with hijab, and this time we're seeing a wave of arrests accusing people of spying for Israel.
How do Iranians, regular people on the ground, feel about all that talk of regime change we've been seeing from Israel and from the US?
Oh, I think there is very divided. So we have different groups with different opinions, but also a group of people have lots of mixed emotions. So obviously those group that are against the regime are happy to see the regime in the weak point, but also they're worried about their country. And there are a group that are against the regime but believe that a foreign force cannot make the regime change and are also worried about that.
Yeah, very complex situation. But Niv, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us about it on the pod this week.
Thank you so much.
You can't stop them. Let them fight for about 2-3 minutes. Then it's easier to stop them.
And then Daddy has to sometimes use strong language.
Every once in a while you have to use a certain word.
Right, so clearly some interesting exchanges between US President Donald Trump and NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte have captured much of the attention from a two-day NATO summit in the Netherlands, which has now come to a close. And no surprise that US President Donald Trump was once again the centre of attention at a multilateral event. This time, though, committing to the entire summit and leaving with a more positive outlook when it comes to international cooperation. And that's largely in response to the key diplomatic purpose of the summit, which was all about increasing the defence expenditure of Western allies. Claudia, did this turn out to be another summit that was just all about appeasing the US president?
Yeah, it certainly seemed like it, not just from Rutte's weird daddy comments, but also look at these text messages he sent to Trump in the lead up. He wrote to him, "Mr. President, dear Donald, congratulations on your decisive action in Iran, something no one else dared to do. It makes us all safer. You are flying into another big success. It was not easy, but we've got them all signed on to 5%. And then he says, Europe is going to pay in a big way, as they should, and it will be your win. It's really getting hard to tell if these are genuine or just sarcastic, but Trump certainly took it as genuine and shared the texts on Truth Social. And then sure enough, the big outcome of the summit, as you mentioned, all members pledging to effectively triple the continent's defense spending to target 5% of GDP, just as Donald Trump wanted. The breakdown of that is 3.5% for core defense, which is troops and weapons, and 1.5% for defense-related measures. These can be things like reinforcing roads so that, you know, military hardware can travel on them without damaging them. Whether they're actually going to be able to make those numbers happen, though, is another thing. 5% is hugely unrealistic for a lot of NATO nations. Mm. Many of them are going to have to make enormous sacrifices in their national budgets to free up that kind of money, or even start looking at things like tax hikes. And that's going to be a hard sell in a lot of these countries. Analysts are already warning that if it leads to tougher economic times than people are already seeing, regular people, then that's only going to push them even further towards far-right nationalist parties, which are already enjoying huge success across Europe.
As always, too many stories this week and not enough time, but here are a few of the other big developments of the past 7 days. starting in Syria, where there was a suicide attack at a Greek Orthodox church in Damascus during a Sunday night service. The health ministry says at least 25 people were killed and 63 more injured when a man opened fire with a weapon before detonating an explosive vest.
A little-known IS splinter group has since claimed responsibility for the attack. Syria's new government, whose own leaders were once associated with IS, say they've now dismantled the cell and seized explosives, suicide vests and ammunition during raids after the bombing.
Georgia has jailed several top opposition figures this week as part of a months-long crackdown on dissent after last October's disputed elections led to massive unrest. Pro-Russian former footballer Mikhail Kavaleshvili was elected president, but many still regard Salom Zurabishvili to be the country's rightful leader. Our colleague Prue Lawan has been speaking with her in Tbilisi.
Do you feel unequivocally that this is being driven by the Kremlin?
Yes.
No doubt whatsoever.
No doubt whatsoever. Why? How? That's very difficult to know. What is the leverage that Moscow has on today's Georgian dream? But what is clear is that Russia is testing in Georgia an alternative to the Ukraine strategy.
Nearly all the leaders of Georgia's pro-Western opposition are now behind bars. Protests are continuing against the ruling pro-Russian Georgian Dream Party, although they are far smaller now, with fears of reprisals taking hold.
And a story that's been getting less attention for the past couple of weeks, Israel's war in Gaza. The UN has now condemned the US and Israeli-backed food distribution system as a, quote, death trap, saying dozens more Palestinians have been killed by Israeli gunfire or shelling while trying to access aid.
The UN says that's now more than 400 people who've been killed by Israeli fire since the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation began its work about a month ago. During a briefing in Geneva this week, UN human rights spokesperson Tamin Al-Hitan said Israel is weaponizing food, which could constitute a war crime. Israel denies deliberately targeting civilians and using starvation as a weapon of war.
So as loyal listeners of World News Weekly will know, we like to finish off each episode with one of the more bizarre stories of the week. Sometimes there's a poetic preamble, other times a moral question like last week that gets to the very heart of our humanity. But on weeks like this, it's perhaps best just to read you the headline. Claudia, would you like to do the honours?
Certainly. Armenian PM Pashinyan offers to show his penis to head of church.
You realise you just read that out loud. Yeah, for all our listeners to hear. Yeah, that is a real headline from a real news site, OC Media, an English language outlet covering the Caucasus. Claudia, please tell us it's not what it sounds like.
Well, actually, Kat, it kind of is. Armenia's Prime Minister, Nikol Pashinyan, is offering to show the head of the Armenian church his privates what? After a priest accused him of being circumcised in a Facebook post. Kat, I guess that's right. What people are using Facebook for these days. Yeah. After a few Google searches that I hope I never have to explain to our employer, I discovered that this is a somewhat common insult that's being hurled at the Armenian PM by critics who accuse him of being an accomplice of Turkey and Azerbaijan, because in Armenia, it turns out, they view circumcision as an Islamic practice. There you go.
So actually, perhaps a justified reason for that headline. Who would have thought? I also did some Googling, although it sounds like mine was a little cleaner than yours. It turns out Pashinyan has been locked in a bitter feud with the church for a while now. Its leader has been calling for his resignation ever since he signed a Russian ceasefire deal over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region in 2020. And it's not the first time the insults have gotten personal. Earlier this month, the PM accused the head priest of fathering an illegitimate child. Obviously a big no-no in the Orthodox Church.
Speaking of no-nos, one to watch for next week, I think. It looks like billionaire Jeff Bezos is in a bit of trouble in Italy over his $85 million wedding. Locals in Venice are protesting it as a sign of gross wealth inequality.
Protesters were threatening to fill the city's canals with inflatable crocodiles to stop his celebrity guests from getting in. That's one way to go about it. So now Bezos has had to find a new venue at the very last minute. Guess we'll see what happens.
Yeah, George Clooney didn't have the same problem, you know.
That's because it's George Clooney, though.
Fair enough.
And that's the world this week. As always, we'll be back next Friday. Claudia, chat soon.
Until then.